3, 2, 1. Advocacy Services attorney Jeff Jesse hasn't been happy with the settlement since new lawsuits sprang up over it. Jesse says the land exchange provision of the settlement is the real problem. Since parcels of the original trust land have been sold, the state plans to use other state lands to serve as a replacement. So now the trust beneficiaries are choosing lands that other groups are interested in, and Jesse says protracted litigation over those lands is not in the best interest of his clients.
The bulk of the settlement, dealing with the trust authority and getting some of the original lands back, those aspects of it are very good and have not led to this increase in litigation. But the land exchange portion is just forcing us to select land that, frankly, is stepping on the toes of some other very powerful interests, and our clients are not well served by taking on so many powerful interests in the state in continuing litigation over a settlement.
Jesse says Advocacy Services will oppose preliminary approval of the settlement. He says he's disappointed that the problems he sees with the settlement now really can't be addressed. Now, Jesse says, his clients have to cut their losses and move in a different direction.
You know, at some point you just have to make a decision whether you continue to stay with something that's proving itself to be unworkable, or at least go back to the original litigation, which is a known quantity. At least you know what you're doing there. That was our original land. We clearly have rights to it. And in our view, at this point in time, we're better off being where we would be in the original litigation instead of being where we are in litigating over this alternative.
Jesse says if there is another alternative, he'd be interested in looking at it. But another attorney who still supports the settlement that got legislative approval last year says it is still the best option. Attorney David Walker represents another group of plaintiffs. Walker says he's sorry to see Jesse withdraw support for the settlement, but Walker says Jesse is mistaken. Walker says the settlement is still in the long-term best interest of the trust beneficiaries, and there is no better approach.
There is no alternative that is expressed. I mean, this is the beginning and the end of it, and it resolves years and years of very difficult litigation. And so, I mean, it's not within the ability of the parties to construct a better settlement. This is just basically it.
Now that Advocacy Services no longer supports the settlement, attorneys representing the trust beneficiaries are more divided. Attorney Philip Voland never supported the settlement for his clients, so that leaves Voland and Jesse arguing against the settlement. Attorneys David Walker and Jim Gottstein still support it, along with the state. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. City Manager Bob Wolting balanced his budget by underfunding the Fairbanks Fire Department. If the City Council wants to continue fire operations past June, Council members need to come up with about $1 million for the department. One way to find that money comes before the council tonight in the form of an 8% tax on cigarettes and tobacco products and boosting the liquor tax from 5 to 8%. The city manager estimates those taxes will bring in more than $1 million next year. The council has already heard from some citizens opposed to the new taxes and have been warned of a petition drive to repeal them if the council doesn't send the issue to voters. In addition to the $16 million city budget public hearing, the council plans to meet with the Fairbanks Development Authority at 5:30 tonight. That meeting was set to determine how to handle the FDA's property after a special election last month dissolved the FDA. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. One. Oxygenated fuel continues to be a topic at borough assembly meetings. Thursday night was no different as citizens updated assembly members on problems they say the fuel is causing.
Good evening. This is Lad McBride running the OxyFuel hotline. I've made that statement over 500 times in the last 6 weeks.
McBride has been logging health complaints filed since the fuel has been used here. The group trying to get oxygenated fuels out of Fairbanks is a citizens group called the Committee for Reformed Gasoline. Lynette Clark says more than 400 people have called the hotline, and they've logged more than 80 pages listing complaints about the fuel. But Clark was at the meeting to object to the borough mayor's proposal to spend $25,000 for a task force to study oxyfuels. Clark doesn't want the borough to spend money studying the fuel. She wants it removed.
I insist that we not be poisoned and have our pockets picked, too.
Clark was one of more than half a dozen people who encouraged the borough instead to spend time pressuring the governor to get rid of oxyfuels. The assembly's presiding officer, Hank Hove, agreed that it's a political problem. State officials risk losing federal funds if they don't comply with the Clean Air Act and take steps to reduce winter air pollution. Hove wants to keep up the pressure on the governor, but he argued against spending money on the study, saying $25,000 isn't going to buy enough of a study for the EPA to take seriously.
They may find it to be interesting. It may be the subject of idle chatter at the water cooler or at the coffee urn, but it is not going to be taken as a serious scientific effort, because it's frankly not a scientific effort. It's too small in scope, and we have no hope. We cannot afford to fund anything large enough to be meaningful in a scientific sense.
The $25,000 would go to University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists. What the borough wants to do is look at workers exposed to the fuels, changes in carbon monoxide concentration in the air, evaluation of car emissions with and without oxyfuels, and take blood samples from people exposed to fuel vapors. The majority of the assembly members say the study is one tool the borough needs in its fight against oxygenated fuel. Paul Chismar supports the expense because he trusts local people to do the work.
I have confidence in the people in Fairbanks, and if we don't get out and do something and depend on other people in the world to do something for us, I don't think anything's going to happen. And surely some good will come out of this study.
While assembly members support the study because they want to document problems with the fuel, that didn't impress the citizens who testified against it. After the vote, Don Burnett and Tim Baumgartner expressed concern about spending money to study people when a fuel they call poison continues to be used. The committee working to get rid of the fuel has been gathering petition signatures. They plan to turn those petitions into the governor's office on Tuesday. Lynette Clark says they have more than 10,000 signatures now. Also on Tuesday, they'll hold a community rally and candlelight vigil at the MAPCO refinery in North Pole to protest the use of oxygenated fuels here. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Since they got together this summer, the Common Concern Coalition has been defining its mission. It has come up with two main ideas. The group believes that if they can help prevent unwanted pregnancies, then abortion would be unnecessary. That's the goal. Trying to keep the discussion away from positions on abortion hasn't been easy, but board member Julie Smith thinks it's necessary to keep the group focused.
At our very first meeting, we decided that we would never debate abortion, and that in fact if abortion came up in our meetings, we would simply say that's not what we're here to talk about and would retreat from that debate, just because we think it's counterproductive to the neutrality that we're trying to preserve on the abortion issue within our group.
Smith is one of the people who started Common Concern after she and a friend decided that debate over abortion polarized people when a common desire was preventing unwanted pregnancy. Another board member, Sarah Swift, says she wants Common Concern to talk about education and prevention, but not just focus on information about birth control.
I think people know what's out there in terms of means of preventing pregnancies, or they know how to get that information. But I think for a lot of, especially teenagers, a lot of it has to do with feeling that you can make that choice, that they have the control over their life, that they have the control to make those choices. And a lot of that has to do with thinking things through in advance before they're in the situation. And so that's, to me, at least one of our goals.
And Colin Reed got involved because he wants children to be born to people who will care about them. He's hoping that the group can work with the school district to address the problems of unwanted pregnancy.
I think the school board is doing a pretty good job in working on issues of self-esteem and empowerment for young people. And we certainly applaud that. We'd like to start working more with individual counselors in the school district and see if there's perhaps some form of talking about this broader issue of wanted pregnancies. Again, if you use the word abortion in the school district, I think you get a lot of people's hair to stand up on end, and as a consequence, that's not productive at all.
Members of the Common Concern Coalition know that measuring success won't be easy, since they can't know how many unwanted pregnancies they might prevent. But Julie Smith says she hopes they can bring together people on both sides of the abortion debate and have them talk about pregnancy prevention techniques. She says if they can talk, she'll consider that a success.
We haven't had a meeting yet where we invited, you know, small groups from each side of the abortion debate. But I would feel successful if we had a meeting and we left and people on both sides had seemed to come together and talk respectfully to each other, especially if they came to the meeting as adversaries and left with respect. I would feel successful. If I had a teenager talk to me about how she had learned something from our group, I would feel successful. I think that's all we can really expect.
The coalition members hope to get more people involved now, people who will work to bring opposites together and share their common concern. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. While the history behind the Mental Health Lands Trust is complicated, one thing is clear. Under the 1991 settlement, state lands are still tied up in the legal dispute, and the legal issues surrounding the trust might not be resolved for many years. Businessmen like Charlie Bodie want to find a way out of the land freeze that's now in effect. All the land Usabelli Coal Mine owns in Healy is trust land. Some was part of the original trust that the state illegally dissolved in the 1970s and technically must put back in the land trust. Other Usabelli land could be claimed by the trustees under the 1991 settlement. As Vice President of Government Relations with Usabelli, Bodie supports another settlement proposed earlier this year by State Senator Jim Duncan. Bodie says it has support from tourism and environmental groups, too. He believes the administration will consider it since the 1991 settlement has not solved the problems it set out to.
This year, the administration, because we have not advanced any further in the courts than we have, will take a serious look at it. I also think that you have enough changes in the legislature that there are enough people there who are interested in bringing about a settlement, and that will in its own, begin to bring pressure to the administration to look very seriously at the alternative.
The legal problems with the 1991 settlement center around a land swap. A lot of the original trust lands have been sold, so rather than reconstitute the trust, the state proposed giving up other state-owned lands to create a new trust. Now other groups with interest in those lands want to get involved in the case, and there are constitutional questions around the settlement. Bodie doesn't expect the settlement tied up in the courts now to get judicial approval.
I believe that the challenges that have been brought to date and the ones that could come if the oil companies are allowed their intervention into the case bring a substantial amount of hurdles to Chapter 66 passing scrutiny under the courts. And if that's true, then we are spending a lot of time right now unnecessarily, trying to whip a horse that never left the gate, so has no chance of going across the finish line.
Supporters of the alternative settlement think it would be easier to forget about the land swap. Under Duncan's bill, the trust would be restored with 500,000 acres of trust land that hasn't been sold or given away, and the state would continue to appropriate 6% of its income to mental health programs. For a new settlement to be approved, though, plaintiffs in the mental health case would have to go along. Attorney Jeff Jesse is one of four lawyers representing plaintiffs in the case. Because of the litigation facing the original settlement, Jesse is considering this second settlement for his clients.
My stand is we are certainly open to looking at alternatives. This certainly hasn't turned out the way any of the parties intended or anticipated, and there's a lot of desire in the public to discuss alternatives, and certainly I'm recommending to my clients that we be open to whatever other possibilities there are.
Jesse says some resolution to the case should mean better mental health services, which he doesn't see happening with extended litigation. The merits of the 1991 settlement haven't even been argued in Fairbanks Superior Court yet, and that's only the first step in the legal decisions affecting this case. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Lawmakers forming the Interior delegation will adjust to each other and their evolving roles in the legislature, but some are going to Juneau with a mission, restoring faith in the system. Democrat John Davies is one of them.
People, if they don't trust the legislature, if they think politicians are somehow bad, if politician is a four-letter word, then they won't be involved, they won't have any sense of ownership of the decisions that we make in Juneau, and I think it's important that people feel a sense of ownership to that process, and they feel like they're in, that we are representing them, and there's not this big dichotomy between the people and the government.
Davey says if people participate, they're more likely to accept the solutions that come from the legislature. He says one of his personal goals is to make the process more orderly and involve the public more. Another new representative, Jeanette James, ran as an outsider who wanted to improve things in Juneau. James agrees that lawmakers need to work on their image.
One of the things that I think we need to do is we need to be able to write down reasons as to why we made a certain vote or made a certain decision and have those reasons that we can communicate those to the people.
James compares her role in the legislature to being on a board. Once a decision is made, you support it whether you voted for it or not. A veteran lawmaker, Steve Frank, will serve on the Senate Finance Committee when he goes to Juneau next month. After 8 years in the legislature, Frank says one of his primary goals is to conduct things in an orderly way and help the public understand how things work, and that all the decisions are not made during the final hours of the legislative session. Frank attended the governor's economic summit in Anchorage this week. He sees that as an educational exercise that serves to help the public understand the problems ahead.
It was helpful, but it didn't provide any immediate, easy, painless answers to our problems, that's for sure. The legislature has been grappling with this issue, and will continue to grapple with this issue. And it won't solve a long-term problem in the short run. I think it will solve the problem incrementally.
Other lawmakers also don't see sweeping changes in the year ahead, but expect the legislature to address things gradually with a long-term view in mind. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Council members began the first of several budget meetings Monday night. They'll be looking at details over the next few weeks. The biggest budget challenge, though, will be coming up with more than $1 million to keep the Fairbanks Fire Department operating. City Manager Bob Wolting says short funding that department was his only choice in coming up with a balanced budget.
If you analyze the situation of the community as well as what our responsibilities are, the fire service is the one area that can be replaced with another source and still provide a service. You cannot do this in police or other areas. But a fire department, there are some options. Voting in a fire district for the community within the city boundaries, that's an option. I, for one moment, wouldn't want 5 minutes without a fire service here.
Councilmember Mike Andrews says he's concerned about Wolting's recommendations for the fire department, but Andrews says it was a way to get the message out.
I think it's sort of a reaction to the way our government has had to function under the tax cap and the balanced budget picture, which is good. I don't believe we're a city that's in debt. We're a city that's very tight and that we have opportunities. So we need to say we reject the idea that we'll shut a department down. We're going to build the department up if we can.
Right now, the city manager is estimating how much money the city might see by raising the alcohol tax from 5% to 8% and taxing tobacco at the same amount. Andrew says he's ready to introduce those ideas as amendments to the budget. Councilmember Jerry Cleworth is a little more hesitant. He thinks the council will try to fund the fire department for the whole year, but Cleworth is not so sure that taxes are the way to go and feels that if the public doesn't get to vote on new taxes first, the process will be drawn out.
They're earmarking certain consumer groups in town and kind of is a bit on the distasteful side to me. And also, I think they're headed for some flack from that area. If we pass those without a vote, then it's going to be petitioned, and that just kills another 2 months out of our time waiting for the petitions to come in to be certified and then calling a special election.
Mike Andrews agrees that might happen, but says the city council needs to take the lead on the issue.
We need to be the horse that pulls the wagon. We need to say that the city needs to go in a certain direction. That's what we are elected for, and I'm willing to put my reputation and right on the line on that account. And if the public decides that by referendum that shouldn't occur, then we'll go to the public for a vote. I don't think the public's going to stop us on something such as the alcohol and tobacco tax.
Council members hold meetings on the budget this week and next. Fairbanks' city budget for 1993 must be adopted by December 15th. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
I understand the cabin folks in Delta until after 3 in the morning. We had a tremendously heavy turnout. And apparently I ran percentage-wise well into the 60s. And I was told by
One of the most difficult things about sexual harassment is defining it, but the rule that was applied is that if you find someone's action offensive, it probably is. Howard Harrell investigates equal employment opportunity complaints for the university and also looks into complaints of sexual harassment. Harrell says the courts have applied a standard called a reasonable victim point of view.
If a victim feels that the behavior that's being exhibited toward them is offensive, then it is offensive. And that's why I have to get called in on these things, because I would be able to look at the issues and sort through the issues to determine whether or not, in fact, the laws and policies have been violated. And I can tell you that if a person comes to me and they feel that they've been sexually harassed, probably 99.9% chance that a law or policy has been violated, if in fact it did occur.
Harrell tries to educate students and staff about harassment and what to do if you think it occurs. Another person who took part in the panel discussion is the director of residence life on campus. Don Foley says it's a learned behavior that often leads to worse problems if you don't confront it early.
If there's not some intervention somewhere, what started out as sexual harassment progresses up the scale to a point where potentially you do get into date rape situations, sexual assault, because if no one intervenes in that particular type of behavior and says this is not appropriate, it does not stop for them.
But if it is learned behavior, Acting Dean of Student Services Carla Kurt says the university should try some re-educating.
And if we as an educational institution can't begin to re-educate people about sexual harassment, then I don't know how in the world corporations are going to do it, or other industry, etc. We should have our act together, and we should really be the role model in terms of promoting change and promoting a sensitivity to self-respect and respecting other people.
One thing these students and faculty members plan to do is take a look at what goes on every day on the campus and see if it encourages certain attitudes. They mentioned entertainment on campus like comedians and movies that may offend some people. But they also brought up the gray areas students can't always identify themselves. Like a student who may want attention from someone in particular. Is it harassment if the wrong person gives the desired response? The faculty member on the panel, Carol Gold, coordinates the Women's Studies program. Gold says it doesn't matter who you desire. Some things simply are not appropriate.
The concern about sexual harassment is going to take the fun out of, quote unquote, men and women interacting. How are they going to interact as men and women? And my response is this interaction as male and female or sexual interaction has no place in a classroom, in an office, in the formal setting. I don't care if it makes the relationship sanitized. Students are not at an institution to get a sexual mate.
One student pointed out that often you don't know your behavior or comment is offensive until someone tells you. So this group decided that's what they'll have to do, even if a remark or action is not directed at them. Some say to observe it and not say anything gives tacit approval. They feel educating people about what others may find offensive in public is the first step toward changing those behaviors. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
I feel comfortable in the decision. I've looked at the law.
I've spent the time, I think, that needed to be spent and made the decision based on the record. No malconduct, no failure to abide by state or borough laws. And more importantly, the record does not show, in my opinion, that the temporary power outage that occurred at Moose Creek Eielson Precinct affected the election or the outcome of the election in any significant way.
3-2-1. On the west side of town, Democrats John Davies, Tom Bryce, and Joe Sitton won their races in districts 29, 30, and 31. Sitton's race was the closest. It wasn't until the final precinct came in that he learned that he'd edged Republican Walt Johnson by less than 100 votes. The east side of Fairbanks went Republican, with Al Vesey taking District 32 and Gene Terrio winning District 33's three-way race. District 34, stretching from North Pole down to Cantwell along the Parks Highway, went for Republican Jeanette James. The other highway district, District 35, which follows the Richardson Highway and stretches to Whittier and Valdez, provided the longest wait of the night and a big turnaround. Democrat Bob Keller led that race for most of the night, but once the numbers from the Delta Junction area finally came in, Republican Harley Olberg got a big boost from his hometown and beat Keller by more than 400 votes. The new District 36, the huge horseshoe-shaped district surrounding Fairbanks that covers several rural villages, will be represented by Democrat Irene Nicolai of Tanana. She got 60% of the vote to Bob Carnahan's 40%. That Senate seat goes to Democrat Georgiana Lincoln, who beat Republican Vern Hurlburt. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson.
No, I didn't expect the race to be this close. And I didn't expect the last 2 weeks of negative campaigning, outright lies, you know, that I was going to raid the permanent fund. I didn't expect Ramona Barnes from Anchorage to take such an interest in this race, and she should take care of things in Anchorage and leave Fairbanks alone.
Yeah, I was really disillusioned, well, not disillusioned, disheartened by the level of negative that took place both at the federal level and at the state level. Not to any great degree in my race, but a little bit, not much. I think that we, during these times, with the state revenues falling, we need to talk about issues, not what another person thinks about the candidate. You know, we need to discuss the issues in an open public forum. I wish more of that had taken place.
So you think budget, obviously a major one, is that going to be top on your agenda as subject to address?
Oh, of course. There's that. There's various programs that need to be reviewed. Not only that, but we got to look at new ways to address our deferred maintenance problems on the university. We got to look at maintaining our human services in this town. Most importantly, I think, though, we got to get jobs going.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Kate Ripley.
Hey, Kate. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Well, my priorities are clear. I said from the outset, education is my number one priority. Health, social services, you know, healthcare system is a really important issue for us. And then we need to have a just basic control on the budget and make sure that we have support for maintaining the infrastructure. So those will be the things I'll be looking at. I'm hoping to get on, I'm going to be working to get on finance committee so I can implement those things.
Now, 3-2-1. Friday morning, West Valley High School students planned to hear from state Senate candidates in one Fairbanks race. The debate was set up by 4 10th grade students. One of them is Mackenzie Dublay.
This is a part of our English class. We had a list of objectives that we needed to accomplish. We needed to either have an interview with the candidate or we had to have a debate.
Students didn't get to meet all the candidates, though. Juanita Helms canceled the night before, so Bert Sharp had about 60 10th, 11th, and 12th graders all to himself. Students want to know many of the same things that adults do, focusing attention on education, social issues, and the economy.
What are your views on the youth center that is starting to gain interest among the people in Fairbanks? And do you think it'll help with some of the youth problems that we have here in Fairbanks.
What do you think are other critical youth concerns?
And what is your position on funding for private schools with state money, as like Monroe or any sort of private school?
How about the teenage pregnancy rate?
Kids Voting is designed to educate children about the election process and increase voter turnout as students in all grades accompany their parents to the polls on November 3rd. They'll be casting kids voting ballots, which will be tallied and reported along with official election results. Kids Voting started in Arizona 2 years ago, and this year 11 states are trying it. Fairbanks schools are piloting kids voting in Alaska. Students learn about the issues and the candidates, but Steve Sanford says the candidates are also learning about the students.
You get to see what the candidates are like, and they're actually paying more attention to us than they probably would normally if we weren't voting.
Some students are making scrapbooks with newspaper and magazine articles about the election. The state's official election brochure has been cut up and pasted to several different posters and bulletin boards. Students aren't just learning about local candidates. The presidential election gets their attention, too, and some were surprised to find there were more names on the ballot than Bush, Clinton, and Perot. Students Ryan Kirsten and Mackenzie Duvlay both say this year they're paying more attention to politics.
If it wasn't for this, I probably wouldn't be watching the debates on TV and following it a little. And Mrs. Henderson has us going through the paper and actually looking at some of the articles on the candidates and stuff.
When this first project started, I was not into it at all. I was just like, this is too much work. I don't want to do it. But now that we're into it, I like doing it, and I think it's interesting, and it's definitely helped me want to, or has definitely made me want to watch the debates on TV.
And even though the kids aren't old enough to officially vote, candidate Bert Sharp finds the students interested in issues that affect their future.
In most instances, they were more direct and showed a more distinct interest on the individual that is asking a question instead of a basic philosophy. It's, you know, when you get older, you start being controlled by philosophies, and younger people, it's a direct interest that is important to them.
Other candidates are scheduled to appear before the same group of students. The benefit of these forums may show up when the results of the kids' votes are tabulated election day. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Before voting yes for a new convention, many people want to know exactly what they'll be getting, and that's not easy to say. Dick Randolph of Shareholders of Alaska believes the Constitution makes it clear. A new convention would have to be similar to the 1955 event, with 55 or 60 citizen delegates elected to meet for some 75 days and propose changes to the Constitution that would have to be voted on by the people. But Mark Boyer with the Save Our Constitution Committee says it's not so clear exactly who will determine the rules of the convention. Even if the public wants proposed amendments to be voted on individually, Boyer says the legislature could decide the mechanics of the convention and could say voters must choose all or nothing.
The interest groups that control all kinds of issues out there will in large part control the mechanics of how this comes together. And that's the unfortunate thing. That's one of the major reasons why I'm opposed to it, is in the next legislature, the same people who've been fighting all the various things that we throw out to scare people, moving of the Capitol, limitations on the legislature, new limitations on the veto power of the governor, subsistence, whatever the boogeyman is that we all throw out, I mean, various people have thrown out, it's the same people who've been controlling those issues will continue to control them while the legislature is shaping the form or the mechanics of the convention. And that's unfortunate, because I think that you will end up, because people won't trust one another, with the legislature saying that it'll all stand or fall together, so that you may have some very, very good things come out of it and some very bad things come out of it, and that the public will vote no because it's a whole package of things, and then they'll be more frustrated.
Legislative involvement is exactly what the people who want a new convention hope to avoid, since they believe the legislature is part of the problem now. Borough Assemblymember Harold Gillum believes that the public wants to vote on each amendment individually and says legislators who oppose voting that way should be recalled. And while some fear that opening the Constitution up to change will mean losing some protections, like a right to privacy, Gillum says just because something may happen doesn't mean it will.
I don't really believe that any responsible individual, knowing the Alaskan voter and the Alaskan electorate, would believe that we would change the right of privacy amendment. Even if it were to get support from 31 delegates to the new Alaska Constitutional Convention. Do you really believe that the people would vote for it? I don't think so. There's lots of safeguards in this whole process, and it really comes down to what do the people wish this state to be.
Gillum and other advocates of a new convention say the key is that voters must approve any changes. But another group opposing the convention says, leave a good document alone. The League of Women Voters believes the process works, since many amendments have successfully been added to the state constitution. The League says the way to make changes is to elect representatives who will do what's right, not to rewrite the constitution. If the ballot measure passes, the delegates to the new convention would be elected at the next statewide election in 2 years, or sooner if the legislature decides to call a special election for the delegates. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Those who want a new convention say it's the only way citizens can make changes that need to be made in the state structure. 3, 2, 1. Those who want a new convention say it's the only way citizens can make changes that need to be made in the state structure. Dick Randolph, chairman of Shareholders of Alaska, says you can't leave it up to the legislature because legislators won't make the changes. Randolph believes this is the time to improve the system.
The legislature has got us in the mess we're in. They've done it by following the rules in that constitution. If we don't take the opportunity to create another body which can act more responsibly, more statesmanlike, and at least present the people with rational changes, and if we don't like the changes, we simply turn them down. If we don't have enough faith in the Alaskans living here now, who've got 35 years of experience with this constitution, who can evaluate the circumstances that exist here now, not what existed 35 years ago, and make a decision what's good for them and their kids, then I think it's a pretty sad commentary on our system.
Randolph charges that those who don't want a new convention fear the electorate, since the public gets to approve any changes that come out of a convention. But Randolph concedes that he also has a fear of the legislature. He believes the legislature has created much of the problem he sees with the Constitution now. But those who want a no vote say the Constitution is not the problem, and if leadership is weak now, that's no reason to change the whole framework of state government. The League of Women Voters has taken a stand against it. Spokesperson Ruth Benson says it's not worth it to open the state constitution up to wholesale changes.
We feel that we may lose more than we stand to gain by having a constitutional convention, that opening the whole thing is risky business at this time when there are some really hot issues that are itching some people that really want to get to them, and they are not necessarily majority issues, and that in addressing those that we may stand to lose some of the very good protections that are in our Constitution.
Benson says the power to change and improve the system already exists. She says the amendment process works. If people want changes in the Constitution, they need to elect people they believe will help make those changes. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1.
Mr. Boko and I are two yo-yos swung by the Borough Assembly.
School board member Jerry McBeth summed up what's been a back-and-forth issue since the October municipal election. Borough Assembly members resolved that last night by certifying McBeth the winner of the race. The Assembly also voted to sustain a veto by the mayor that threw out an election appeal made by the losing candidate, Bob Boko. The vote means there won't be a special election to decide the school board race. Boko requested a new election, contending that a brief power outage at Eielson Air Force Base on Election Day may have kept some people from voting. 2 weeks ago, the Assembly agreed with Boko and declined to certify the election for that school board race, which was decided by 27 votes. A lawsuit was filed challenging that action, and the mayor's veto sealed the victory for McBeth since there weren't 8 Assembly members to support an override. Assembly members heard plenty of testimony during a lengthy meeting. Many of those testifying opposed the new election on the basis of cost and because voter turnout would be smaller than in a regular election. Opposition came from a student, Marcus Erlander.
Now, first of all, I think it's quite ridiculous that because for 20 minutes people are inconvenienced from voting, that 20,000 people would be inconvenienced to vote again for a new election.
Adults also testified that just because some people were inconvenienced is no reason to set a precedent like calling for a new election. Mim Dixon questioned where concerns about one voter not getting to the polls might lead.
If we find any circumstance where one person is denied a chance to vote, for example, there's an accident on the Richardson Highway and traffic's held up and somebody can't get there, and some one person's denied their chance to vote, would we have another election? And if it's because we're concerned about the one person that didn't get the chance to vote, why shouldn't they be able to vote for all the candidates again?
2 weeks ago, assembly members were told that the election must comply with state law to be valid, and there was some concern that the 20 minutes voters were told they couldn't vote on the base precinct might have violated the law. That prompted assembly members to agree with BOCO's appeal. And BOCO's campaign manager, Lisa Seitz, told them last night that they did the right thing.
There's been a lot of talk about we live within convenience here. Yes, we do, but weather is not a locked door in your face.
The two candidates had a say as well. Macbeth felt the borough assembly should agree with the mayor's decision, since there wasn't evidence to find problems with the election, and a special election would not be a fair way to resolve it.
Well, the assumption is that by having a special election, the option is equally available to everybody. It is not equally available to people who are out of town for 1 or 2 months who may not hear about it. Because it is special. It is not a regularly scheduled election. Those people are excluded. It is not equally available to individuals who do not happen to have a commanding interest in the race.
And Bob BOCO may have seen the vote to sustain the veto coming. At the end of his testimony to the assembly, BOCO vowed that he would be back.
In the event that you go along with his veto, I want you to know this. When I filed for this seat, I felt that I was eminently qualified for this job. I know school finance, I know school law, I know curriculum, students, staff, and parents, and I know how to work with them. Now, most of all, I want you to know that I am qualified, and I know that right today. And I will run again next fall. And I'll tell you now, I will win.
BOCO could still go to court now to challenge the election certification. Three assembly members who voted against the appeal 2 weeks ago voted with the mayor last night, Cheryl Kilgore, Bob Coghill, and Hank Bartos. They were joined by the newest assembly members, Nancy Jones and Valerie Therrien. Of the six who originally supported BOCO's appeal, Walt Johnson and Guy Satley also voted to override the mayor. Donna Gilbert is no longer on the assembly, and Harold Gillum was absent. Hank Hove and Lane St. John voted for the appeal last month, but last night voted to sustain the mayor's veto. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
There is no evidence to the effect that the power outage on Eielson and the brief period during which ballots were not passed out had the effect of biasing the election results.
The mayor, in my opinion, acted unilaterally and in an arbitrary and capricious manner, disregarding the preponderance of written evidence and testimony.
Three, two, one. For the last few years, the city has kept at least four officers working each police shift. That's a number that the department set with the city council's nod of approval. But the union wants more than that. It wants it in writing, so that the city won't suddenly say it's okay to have fewer officers working. Attorney Brett Wood represents the police officers' union. He says every city's police operation considers the public safety, police officer safety, and the effectiveness of the police department operation. But Wood says the issue here is the officer safety.
The staffing has gotten so low at the Fairbanks Police Department that such considerations or criteria as operational effectiveness or public safety have almost gone out the window. The patrol force as it exists now is almost exclusively an emergency response force. And the only thing left is the safety consideration. Safety is something that the employer has to bargain about, and the city refuses to do it. So we're going to go to the Labor Relations Agency and ask them to force them to do it.
The city went to court over minimum staffing levels once before with another union. Then Fairbanks firefighters pushed safety as the issue in a civil case and won that point. But Deputy City Attorney Pat Cole says the firefighters' issue is different.
What we have there is we have equipment staffing, where we agree that to operate the fire truck requires X number of people to do it. A lot of cities have that kind of stuff as far as equipment manning or staffing. But the police, it's a much more nebulous area as far as what is adequate police protection. And no one can really agree on what the ideal way to measure it is, but everyone agrees that we're too low.
Cole says the city is arguing against making minimum staffing levels a contract point for two reasons. One is that it was raised by the union when the current contract was negotiated, but the union later dropped the idea. Cole says the contract bars the complaint now. Cole's second point is that it's the city's prerogative to set staffing levels.
We are required to negotiate safety issues, of course, as far as performing certain duties and how you handle workload, but the determination about how many officers are employed, we believe, is the city council's discretion.
The city and the union won't know for a while whether or not minimum staffing should be bargained. Both attorneys say the Labor Relations Agency takes anywhere from 6 months to a year to decide some issues. Meanwhile, a civil court case filed by the union against the city also hinges on the minimum staffing issue. Attorney Brett Wood says if the Labor Relations Agency rules that it is a negotiating point, the lawsuit ensures that the city has a legal obligation to pay for whatever gets negotiated into the contract.
The city has a history of coming up with what essentially is this empty pockets argument, saying, well, okay, we have this obligation, but we haven't got the money to do it, so we're not going to do it. It's this other problem that the lawsuit addresses.
The city's contract with the police union expires in June. Addressing the minimum staffing issue now will help set some of the ground rules when new contract talks begin. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Business owners and people who live near Cushman and Gaffney Streets provided the public opposition to the liquor license transfer. RJ's Lounge had to move from its 3rd Avenue location this summer when the Fairbanks Development Authority cleared the block as part of its downtown improvement efforts. RJ's owners want to move the bar 10 blocks south, but residents like Dan Creviston told the city council that there are plenty of bars and liquor stores in that area now.
We feel that the 4 businesses dispensing liquor within the short distance is enough to quench the thirst of individuals. In other words, pardon the pun, we don't need a 5th.
Like Creviston, many people pointed out the bar's proximity to schools, churches, and residences. And other business owners, Don Weldon of Vista Travel across the street, and the Cars Foodland manager, worried about what one more bar would mean in an area of town they're trying to improve. Board members of the Rescue Mission believe people they're trying to help don't need another bar nearby. Charles McLeod owns the Good News Bible and Bookstore a couple doors down.
Already, customers are talking to us about their personal safety. They're worried about it. They have this idea that they may be accosted in the parking lots. Even if it doesn't happen, the idea that it may does bring fear into customers, which means that they won't come to the store.
Others worry that RJ's clientele will follow the bar to its new location. Stuart Rothman says safety will be a factor.
I don't want to point fingers, but you take a place where people have been known to overindulge, where people walk out in the middle of the street and go where they want to go without regard to traffic or traffic lights, and you want to move it to the busiest intersection in this town, I think it's just an accident looking for a place to happen.
The majority of the people who spoke to the council opposed the transfer, but a few felt that RJ's was being singled out, and some raised the question of discrimination, since many Native Alaskans were customers. Don Carlin has tended bar at RJ's.
You closed the Savoy, that was a meeting place for the Native people. Everybody that come into town. Now, they have no place to meet. Now, I don't think it's fair that a bunch of business people should be able to tell somebody else that they can't move a business into there.
And the attorney for RJ owner, Vera Stoltz, says the family has a stellar business reputation. Gary Foster told the city council that it should give the bar a chance based on the facts.
They've put a lot of money and a lot of effort into renovating that building. Some $45,000, half of which was borrowed from local banks. And yes, there's going to be taxes generated from this establishment. And no, they do not have an intention of taking the clientele or patronage that they had downtown with them. They want to have a family-oriented, after-work lounge, and they have a good location for it.
But the council voted against the transfer, pointing to hundreds of signatures on petitions opposing the liquor license going there. Council members say it's not a question of discrimination or the owner's reputation, but based on concerns in the neighborhood. The protest will be sent to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, which decides whether to approve the license transfer. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The EPA is sticking by the OxyFuels program. Air pollution engineer Mike Lidgard says it will cut back on winter air pollution.
We know for a fact what these fuels do for carbon monoxide. We know that carbon monoxide levels in Fairbanks are a concern. They violate a standard which was established to protect public health. And this program is very effective in reducing carbon monoxide levels.
That fact is being questioned by a chemistry professor in Denver who's been studying the effect of the fuels over the 5 years they've been used there. He can't conclude that OxyFuels actually made a difference.
There are very clear downward trends in the carbon monoxide concentration, but those downward trends in carbon monoxide existed before oxygenated fuels existed and have continued since they've existed.
University of Colorado at Denver professor Larry Anderson says he's worked in the field of air pollution for 20 years. In the first part of a two-part study he's published, Anderson says he looked at data showing what happened to the air quality in Denver.
We can see no statistically significant effect on ambient concentrations of CO as a result of the use of oxygenated fuels. If that effect had been about 10%, we would have been able to detect it with statistical confidence. Now it should be up to close to a 20% effect, and we see nothing.
Anderson says the EPA designed its program to look at models and lab tests. He's looking at actual air quality data in a way the EPA hasn't accepted yet.
Most of the EPA people that we've discussed this with don't really believe that you can look at ambient data and figure out what's really going on. We are certainly convinced that we can do that. This is a new technique that we've developed, and it'll have to undergo further scrutiny by multiple people before it will be widely accepted. But it's certainly an important tool, it would appear, for looking at the effects of this kind of a program.
The other part of Anderson's study is to determine if burning the fuels increases the atmospheric concentrations of formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is a suspected carcinogen on the list of hazardous air pollutants that EPA is supposed to be dealing with. Anderson says emission studies show formaldehyde's increase in the air when oxyfuels are used, but they can't prove it's because of oxyfuels. EPA engineer Mike Lidgard says they didn't know about Anderson's study until last week, and they're getting a copy of it. And the agency is interested in studying what happens with oxyfuels here, but hasn't committed to doing that. Lidgard says he's not worried about the health questions that have been raised.
We have admitted that aldehydes will probably increase slightly with the use of oxygenated fuels. However, there are some other benefits related to toxic pollutants from oxyfuels. For example, we expect benzene emissions to go down slightly with the use of oxygenated fuels. So we have looked at it. We do not expect toxics to increase very much with the use of the fuels.
In a letter to the EPA last week, DEC Commissioner John Sandor suggested that if the agency supports the use of oxygenated fuels in cars, then it should pay for funds to study the impact of the new fuels in Arctic conditions. After talking with Anderson, the state estimates the cost of a 3-year study to be $75,000. Anderson says that's cheap, even though the EPA says it has looked at the fuel's effectiveness in minus 20 degree weather. Anderson says more study may generate some real information.
Oxygenated fuels should really have been evaluated in a systematic way, and the effects should have been looked at in a systematic way and under a variety of different climatic conditions. I mean, Denver is much different than Phoenix and Tucson, and both of them are much, much different than Fairbanks and Anchorage and so on.
While he encourages more study, Anderson sees no immediate health concerns from the new fuels. He says any increase in formaldehyde is likely to be small with no short-term effects, but he says the fuels should be studied to see if they're doing more harm than good. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. After 3 years on the Borough Assembly, Democrat John Davies thinks he's ready to take over for Nilo Kopanen in Juneau. During his successful primary campaign, Davies felt that race would determine the election. He sets education, health and social services, and capital improvements at the top of his priorities list. Trimming the state budget will mean looking at all programs, says Davies, including things like the longevity bonus.
There are some programs that we put in there that are nice to have, but not essential, and I think maybe one right now that I would just say as an example would be the longevity bonus. I think that here's a case where we're giving $250 a month to everyone, regardless of whether they need it or not. That's a very nice thing to do, but I'm not sure that we can continue to afford to do that sort of thing.
One of Davies' opponents is Phyllis Hunsucker, a Republican, who says her top priority in Juneau will be to stop bad legislation. Hunsucker believes the budget needs to be cut, but she also supports a $200 a person tax to pay for education.
That would pull in the rural Alaska because they do get a permanent dividend check, with perhaps the option of checking off, if they so choose, to have $200 withdrawn from their permanent fund. Rural Alaska tends to be a low cash economy, but I think there's a way that we can get them to help with our education plans.
Hunsucker also wants to see more job creation in Alaska. Development is also high on the list of priorities for the third candidate. Alaskan Independence Party candidate Don Wright wants to see the budget cut 5% across the board, and he doesn't want to see a school tax.
I do not think we should ever have any school taxes or any income taxes or any kind of taxes. I think all we need to do is to raise the severance tax on the oil. We'll have all the money we need for all the schools we need to do whatever we want. Use it prudently with cost effectiveness and don't let it get out of hand.
Wright says his top responsibility in Juneau will be to represent the people in District 29. All three candidates made their comments on KUAC's ballot programs, which air next week. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 3, 2, 1. Diversify the economy is the campaign theme of Republican Walt Johnson. Johnson stresses jobs in his bid for state house. An investment agent, Johnson has served 5 years on the borough assembly. Since there won't be any Fairbanks incumbents returning to serve in the House, Johnson thinks his experience will help him fill that gap.
Past history has taught us that when you send a new Congress, when you elect a new Congress, a lot more gets done than if you send people, continue to send the same people down there. And I anticipate that we will get a lot done once we go down there. And of course, with my background, I'm an investment advisor. I'm concerned about diversifying our economy. I'm concerned about expanding our economy. Those are the types of things I'm going to focus on, because my number one priority is job creation here in Alaska, because all these other things that we're talking about are not going to happen unless we have an economy that works. We have to have an economy that works before we can provide all these other services.
Johnson says he can't give specific examples of places in the state budget he'd like to see cut, but he says he does not favor cutting education or the longevity bonus. Democrat Joe Sitton is also in the running in District 31. He says his first piece of legislation will be a child's bill of rights, ensuring every child an adequate education. He also supports an endowment program to fund education. Sitton says the state's problem isn't lack of money, but lack of priorities. He also thinks he can help Fairbanks get the political clout it needs in Juneau.
What will give me the ability to get the job done for Fairbanks down there, number one, is the fact that I understand the issues facing us. Number two, I know a lot of the movers and shakers and doers who are going to be in that legislature down there. And in fact, I'm already dealing with them on economic plans. And number three is that I intend to, if we can't bring Juneau to Fairbanks, I intend to bring Fairbanks to Juneau by as thoroughly as possible, including the people in my district in the decision-making process. I intend to routinely poll them on questions before us and things like that.
Sitton also wants to see fewer lobbyists in the Capitol. Sitton served on the Borough Assembly in the 1980s. He owns a bookstore and the All Alaska Weekly newspaper. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The campaign themes of so many running for office this year also resound in the District 32 race: jobs and education funding. Education funding certainly ranks high for Democrat Don Gray, who's been a high school teacher here for many years and is a former member of the State Board of Education. Gray supports the ideas of the Institute of Social and Economic Research. which has a plan for meeting the state budget needs into the future.
We've got to cut back on state budget because there's not enough money. We've got to increase revenues through a combination of things like the school tax. Half of 1% for a $40,000 a year income would be $200 per family. We've got to do more with less. But specifically for the school funds, that's one of the few state responsibilities that we have. The current foundation unit is $61,000. It has to be protected. If it can't be increased, it certainly should not be cut.
Gray says if elected, he'll push for forward funding of education so local schools can plan ahead. And he thinks a school tax is a fair way to help pay for education. Gray also puts health care and job creation as issues he wants to address in Juneau. One of his opponents, Alaskan Independence Party candidate Art Griswold, is also pushing for job creation. Griswold wants to open Alaska land to the people and make access to the land easier. But he doesn't necessarily agree that the state's education system is underfunded.
We keep hearing the school budget is insufficient in different levels, so on and so forth. Then we go back and we start to look at it closely, and we find there is extremely high wages paid in the upper management end, and the lower end is being cut to do so. I think before we do anything more about worrying about funding more than what we have, we do a study and reduce the inefficiencies in the high end and put them in the low end and see if we can accomplish more with education first. Then, if necessary, we go back to the people and say, do you want to spend more for your educational fund?
Griswold wants to look at some of the same issues in cutting the state budget. He says upper-level management is one of the first places to look for budget cuts. Gray says he doesn't have a hit list of places to cut, but doesn't want to see cuts across the board. Neither does Republican Al Veazey. Veazey says it would be mismanagement to cut across the board, but he's also opposed to tax increases to raise more revenue.
There is only one way that Alaska can produce income revenues in a manner to which it is accustomed, and that is through resource development. We have vast resources in this state, and we are not making any serious effort at all towards developing those resources. The people in this state cannot make up for that revenue basis out of their pockets. To try to make up for Prudhoe Bay through taxation on people would require confiscating everybody's wealth. There would be nothing left over. I am opposed to tax increases at this time, sales tax increases, income tax increases, right down the line, because our economy can't bear the pressure.
Veazey's campaign theme is to repeal regulations and statutes that hold up development in the state. He considers the state's current water quality regulations absurd. He also supports term limits for lawmakers. Democrat Don Gray opposes term limits, saying people can limit legislative terms at election time. All three of the candidates made their comments on KUAC's ballot programs, which air this week. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The race to represent downtown Fairbanks and the Fort Wainwright area includes two-term borough mayor Juanita Helms. The Democrat sees too much of state government being centralized in Anchorage at Fairbanks' expense. As a state senator, Helms says she'd like to encourage small businesses, like she did with the borough's Economic Development Center.
I think developing the small cottage type of industries in Alaska to add value to some of the resources that we develop is a way of making sure that Alaskans are employed and have an income. And the Senate can do something by way of funding, like the BIDCO bill that was introduced and passed, but not funded last year, which gives a source of loans to small businesses so they can do business.
One of Helms' opponents, Republican Bert Sharp, doesn't necessarily agree. After 4 years in the House of Representatives, Sharp wants to be in the Senate next year. He says the state's role should be to keep policies stable and make sure the rules don't change so investors will come here. Sharp believes the private sector can handle loans.
I do not advocate the state getting involved in any major loans because in the past that's proven to be an exercise in futility and tens of millions of dollars that went down the tube. I think there's adequate commercial financing available. The state can get involved on a seed money situation to just get them started and to provide help to get the technology, but as far and location, but as far as actually getting involved in long-term loans of any significant size, I think it goes against the economics, the reality of economics.
Helms and Sharp also don't agree on how the state should cut its budget by $500 million. Sharp wants to reorganize things and eliminate work duplicated within various departments. Helms says consolidation won't save that much money. She'd rather see some top management jobs cut and perhaps a cap on the permanent fund dividend. The third candidate in the race is Alaskan Independence Party member Frenchie DeRocher, who wants to change government altogether. DeRocher would like to cut some upper-level bureaucrats out of the budget, but he doesn't buy into the talk about what the state says it can do to encourage more investment. DeRocher says the best way to create jobs is to get the government out.
The last 15 years when Alaska had money, we've heard how from every new group of legislators, how we must develop our resources, have value-added products, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing's ever been done. We've got a real, I hate to use the term, bottleneck in Juneau. It has to be broken. That can only happen with legislative reform and government reform. Certainly, we need to eliminate hundreds of do-nothing regulatory bureaucracies. And that in itself would create an awful lot of American free enterprise.
DeRocher also supports a new constitutional convention. The three candidates do not agree on tort reform. Sharp says he'd like to cap liability costs. Helm says it's tough to write a law to cap personal injury limits when victims all have different stories. And DeRocher says he'd like tort reform to include a measure saying no lawyers could be in the legislature. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
I would like, as Alaska's senator, to get our priorities focused on our education system and the education of our people. I don't understand how every governor and the president agree to the 2,000 points of light and then we can't find the money to fund it. I also want to get the economy moving again with programs that ensure that we create quality jobs and a quality product. We have to have solid, sound jobs based on resource development that'll keep our young people in this state, that'll provide us with a living, an educational system, health benefits. You just can't do that with big and more government, whether it be federal or state. It's got to be brought about by developing this economy, by encouraging the environmental community to come aboard on projects like ANWR so we can make it safer. If we can send a man to the moon, we can certainly open up ANWR safely if we're lucky enough to find oil.
We need to get off of a single monolithic oil-based economy that we're on. Conservation and utilizing our oil development to its fullest potential, possibly even developing it to process before it leaves the state of Alaska, is where we need to invest. We need that in timber, we need that in fisheries. In fisheries, we have wasted byproducts. In the southeast, there is a company called Alaskans, which processes salmon skin to its fullest potential. There is no waste of that product in the southeast due to that. That is what we need to do on all of our resources in the state of Alaska.
By adding this additive, might it result in additional toxicity of a consequence that would be of concern? We don't know that now. I'm not satisfied that tests were done previously by EPA really addressed the issue prevailing in Fairbanks when it's 35 or 40 degrees below zero. We can't get that information. EPA has not come out with the study that they promised with regard to the cold weather testing. So here we're left starting a system the 1st of November. The refineries are up. The price, I understand, is about 14 cents a gallon in addition. And we want to make sure that there's no consequences of this relative to the fact that this is a highly toxic additive that's going in the fuels.
3, 2, 1. A 2-hour power outage on Eielson Air Force Base did not shut the polls down on Election Day, but for more than 20 minutes after the power first went off, voters were asked to wait or to drive 12 miles to the closest precinct in North Pole to vote. Even though the Assembly felt that officials handled the election properly, the majority of the Borough Assembly agreed with school board candidate Bob Boko that enough people may have been confused or discouraged from voting because of the problems there. With 27 votes separating the apparent winner, Jerry Macbeth, from Boko, some Assembly members argued that nearly 100 people would have had to be discouraged from voting to impact the results, and that that hadn't happened. But others couldn't be certain how many people might not have voted because of the power outage, and that it would be better to hold the election for that seat all over again. Bob Boko says he didn't have the money to take the matter to court if the Assembly had certified Macbeth the winner, so he was surprised but pleased to get a second chance.
They've spoken to the right of people to vote, no matter what. Under any circumstances, people have the right to vote. And the only reason I did this was because of those people calling me and saying, hey, I didn't get a chance to vote. And I'm with the people.
And Jerry Macbeth says he was surprised, too. He didn't think there was much evidence to show that the outcome might have been changed. But Macbeth says it's a touchy issue and to be taken seriously if even one person didn't get to vote. The Assembly still has to set an election date for that school board race. Following the decision to hold the election again, the Assembly unanimously passed a resolution asking the state to create separate polling places for people who don't live on military bases, saying that it's inconvenient for voters who don't live on the bases to pass through the military checkpoints to get to the polling places now. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.